Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to continue to learn, pray, and act as we appeal to heaven so that we can actually start focusing on the things that will help us get just get engaged and getting other people engaged. It's that third word, act. You realize that knowledge is power, but it doesn't become power until you act upon the knowledge. So just trying to connect the dots here, folks. It's all about constitutional compliance. And there is just so, the mess is so big. I know that most people look at it as really overwhelming. But if you really follow, if you understand contractual deviations, how there are variances that come up in a contract, There are constitutional, or I should say, contractual processes. It's called an audit. The audit process is to basically look at the variances and to determine what is necessary to get back on track. This isn't rocket science. And I believe that most people, when you start really reading these documents and start understanding how they assumed powers, how they deviated powers, then I think we can place context to what we need to do. Now, Tammy's not here today. She's got this stupid engagement called family obligations. I'm just kidding. You know, family obligations always come first, and it is actually back to school. And so it kind of snuck up on her. Literally, she realized that today or tomorrow, whenever there's the first day of school, and that she's going to have to actually, you know, go and get things ready, I guess, connect. I don't know what the process is. It's been so long, and they've probably made it very difficult. But nevertheless, this gives us an opportunity to kind of look at where things are currently and where I think we might be able to apply motivation, might be able to apply pressure. You come up with how you want to, you know, put it into context. But I believe that we're in a position where we might actually get an outcome that would keep us from getting pushed off the cliff. And what I mean by this is, if you have not read Why Counties Matter Most, it's actually been highly acclaimed by a lot of people that are reading it and recognizing things to do. I mean, shoot, my article, Why Counties Matter Most, it spawned a whole new movement, a whole new myopic movement. I had no intention of doing this, and I'm not even supporting it. But there's this, you know, new movement of creating constitutional or county conventions, like a state convention for, you know, the Article 5 Convention of States. So this movement in trying to create this county convention to take over a state constitution, and the intent of this, I've kind of covered this already, but the intent is to do this one thing, going into a convention, and the outcome is just one thing, getting the county's suffrage back in the state senate. And what that means is getting the representation restored. Well, it's just not that simple. As a matter of fact, the real crux of the problem is that the Supreme Court, the Warren Court specifically, in the 1960s, used a unconstitutional jurisdiction over a case that the federal court, again, had no jurisdiction over. And the cases were, these lawsuits were individuals in different states. Reynolds v. Sims actually was Baker v. Carr first, and then Reynolds v. Sims. And I think Baker v. Carr was Kentucky or Tennessee or something like that. The other one was a different situation, but it was the similar. The similar outcome was one person, one vote. This became a principle, a mantra of the Supreme Court, one person, one vote. And they created a mandate, unconstitutionally, mind you. I mean, seriously, unconstitutionally. You've been hearing me tell you that the courts are passive by design in the Constitution. They don't have the authority to just reach down, you drive agendas. They can't make law. They can't interpret many of the things that they've done. So one thing, and I'm going to write it down because this is essential. I believe that there needs to be a clear article written. And so now that I, you know, when you get moved, you say, oh, you know, I've got to do this. So now I'm going to do this. I'm going to write an article that basically exposes the Federalist Papers. I'm going to write an article that exposes how the Federalist Papers were the poisonous pill. How they basically injected in the last Federalist Papers after the Constitution was ratified. In other words, it's almost like Alexander Hamilton, all on his own, sat down and wrote these theoretical Federalist Papers, these last eight Federalist Papers. And inside there, he basically created this green light to unleash the judiciary to be able to do what it was doing in England. Now, the judiciary was very limited based on the Constitution. The Federalist Papers is where the concept of interpretation, the concept of case law, the concept of creating law was, you know, a normal practice in England, and he was alluding to, this was never confronted. In other words, when he put these in, so I'm going to write an academic article to show how he literally sat and waited months. He waited months to write these articles on the judiciary, and he waited until New Hampshire was guaranteed, because he got notification from Gary, Eldridge Gary, out of Massachusetts, because he was close to the people in New Hampshire. And Eldridge Gary said, they're going to rubber stamp this. And sure enough, when they met, because they were a small state, they were one of the states in the convention that demanded the equal suffrage of, that the state's equal suffrage cannot be deprived of them. In other words, the Amendment Protection Clause in Article 5, where a state cannot lose its equal suffrage in the Senate without its consent. We've covered this so many times through the notes on the Constitutional Convention, through the ratification debates. I've even talked about this regarding the 17th Amendment. So as we look at Eldridge Gary and Matt or Hamilton basically getting the green light that there was going to be the ninth state to ratify, in other words, the federal constitution was done. Now, I've been on record to say that the federal constitution really needed another big state. In other words, it either needed New York or Virginia to ratify to make sure that there was enough support, populist support. Why? Because if you look, I mean, Virginia was almost 700,000, going on 700,000 people in the state. And so as we look at the importance, because Virginia, that would have almost made up, if I remember correctly, it made up one quarter, almost one quarter of, or maybe one sixth, I think, one fifth or one sixth of the entire population of the United States. So getting a big state and having the big ports, New York being a big port, Virginia being big ports as well, and having a big, I'll just say, capability of commerce and doing commerce, not having one of those two big states would have been problematic. Now, not having one of those two states and just moving and traversing throughout the republic, you know, in other words, having to bypass Virginia, and or having to bypass New York, getting commerce from Massachusetts down to Georgia. if one of those states didn't join the union, then those states could actually start harassing the union to say, you want to bring your stuff through, you're going to have to pay us for it. It would have been a great opportunity to actually start playing those types of games, but they would be at risk of possibly getting into a military conflict. Now, the whole point was, and the tone at the Constitutional Convention was to maintain the union. I mean, they were making political compromise over the repugnant concept of maintaining slavery when all men were created equal. So as we look at what Hamilton was doing with his Federalist Papers, these last eight Federalist Papers, I need to write an article that actually shows how he waited and then what he put into those Federalist Papers that cracked open the door where nobody, and it's not like, you know, it was peppered all over the place. It was buried very interestingly and well hidden, or I should say well placed, in where Hamilton was just making these common sense, you know, it is just a common practice that the judges have the ability to interpret law. As a matter of, and he even went down this path of saying, when it comes to a nation where the interpretation could vary, there needs to be a national standard in interpreting. Well, if that's the case, the national standard has to come from the states, because it's the state's constitution, not the federal constitution. This is how it all got perverted. The Federalist Papers were the drive for this. And so as the Federalist Papers unleashed this monster called the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary, it didn't take long after the Constitution was ratified where the states actually stepped in and go, we want to peel back some of your jurisdiction out of the Constitution. And that's where the 11th Amendment came in. Now, there's a video that's been cycling around that actually is, I think it's on, not CNN, what is the national propaganda, NPR, I think it's an NPR video, where Newt Gingrich was talking about the history of the judiciary in Britain and the sentiments of the framers when they were creating this new constitutional republic. Now, there's a lot of things that Newt Gingrich says that's wrong, and that's only because he's a federalist. He looks at the federal government as having the repository of the power, where he does not utter the words that the states have the repository of power. When he basically says that the courts don't have that power, he misses what Madison says in the Virginia, in Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions of 1800, he completely misses how Madison says how the judiciary cannot assume these types of powers and a jurisdiction over things not within the Constitution. So when it comes to things that are not constitutional, where they don't arise under the Constitution, such as creating a law that violates the Constitution and or assumes a power, like immigration or something like that, the only entity that has the ultimate say over that, as Madison clearly, you know, reiterates and reiterates and reiterates, he emphatically reiterates that only the states, being the parties to the compact, have the rightful power and responsibility of keeping the federal government, or that creature that was created by the compact itself, being the federal government being created out of the Constitution, that creature was to be kept in check by the states, by the parents. So Newt Gingrich really missed the boat on this. But that's because this was actually a presidential speech. And so I've got the transcripts, I've got the link now, and that's thanks to Loud and Liberty. It was actually, I think, Sean, who's a principal involved with Loud and Liberty out of Virginia. And I don't even think he's from Virginia. But anyway, he sent me the link. There was a transcript that was a part of it, and it's on NPR. But what we'll do is we're going to create this article that exposes the Federalist Papers. But the next article we're going to actually dive into is an article that exposes the atrocity the subversive action of the court, be very specific, the subversive action of the Warren court. Now, we've already got a petition that deals with this. This is Petition 8. Petition 8 lays out that the only body within the federal government that has legislative powers are the representatives, or I should say Congress. That the legislative body is the only body that has the authority to create law. Now, in Article or in Petition 8, we do point out that the president possesses negative legislative powers, which means that he has the ability to veto, but he can't write a law. He can say this, and actually, I think this was a shortcoming in the Constitution, because I believe the presidential veto should have actually been able to permanently kill a bill if he could lay out the argument that the bill that was being presented by Congress was unconstitutional, ergo it would basically pull the rug out from underneath Congress to be able to overthrow his veto or overpower it with a two-thirds vote. I mean, right, wrong, or indifferent, if something is not within that Constitution, and even though you may have a majority of the members of Congress willing to violate the Constitution, the president should have the power to say, I don't care what you're doing, you can't do that. And he should be able to make an appeal to the Supreme Court to basically say, where in the Constitution does this power, is this power derived from? What enumeration in Article 1, Section 8 can Congress basically claim that they have the authority to create this law regarding immigration? Not regarding an uniform rule of naturalization, regarding immigration. Because immigration is not an enumeration given to the federal government. Immigration was actually granted to the states. Now, this is a can of worms that, you know, people go, you're just confusing things. Actually, no, it's not confusing. The reality is this, that a person that comes across the border without initiating an immigration process, federal or with the state, and it should be done by the states. The states need to take it back. But without having an authority to enter into the United States because they've been approved for immigrating into the United States, and they come across the border, bypassing a port of entry, sneaking in, that makes them an invader by definition of the Constitution. So there's a few petitions we have in play. And what the heck is any of this got to do with Trump? Because I believe, folks, if you really look at probably the two primary issues that Trump has been struggling with, is getting America, you know, cleaned out from this invasion and fighting the courts. Clearly, in Why Counties Matter Most, when we talked about how the courts have assumed power, and what they did was they unconstitutionally demanded that the states reconfigure themselves politically to ignore the county governments, the governments of the people, and to ignore those governments and set up and establish legislative districts that are based on population to ensure that every person has an equal vote in representation. Now, I defy anybody to show me where that is actually within the Constitution, where that's a guaranteed right, a protected privilege for a person, that you're to have equal representation. That's not even between states. What I mean by that is, the state that has the best representation, bar none, is Wyoming. It's the least populated state, and so they have 500,000 people to one representative. Even though the Constitution doesn't allow anything greater than 30,000, get that right, the Constitution doesn't allow anything greater than 30,000 to be represented by a person in the House of Representatives. So the point is this, is as we look at the representation in the House of Representatives growing to this point, where did that come from? This was another thing that Congress assumed. Now, I just went down a rat hole. The point is that Wyoming because every other state or every other representative is usually representing somewhere around 600 to 700, almost 800,000 people. So the 500,000 to one representative, clearly their voice is a little bit greater or more heard than these bigger pools, right? When you have more people fighting for that one representative, then, you know, the chance of you being heard is very slim, or gets slimmer and slimmer. This is one of the reasons why Washington, George Washington, at the end of the Constitutional Convention, said, I don't think a person could be adequately represented by 40,000 people to one. In other words, having one representative have to represent 40,000, let alone 100,000 or 750,000. George Washington said 40,000 is too many for one person to represent. And so basically what they did was they changed the Constitution, actually was moved to change the Constitution from 40,000 to 30,000. And so it was ingrained. Now the Bill of Rights, and I go down this all the time, the Bill of Rights actually included an amendment to deal with the changing of apportionment to representation, because they're both the same. And so in so putting that, or putting that into the Bill of Rights, with Madison including that one amendment on apportionment, of changing apportionment from 30,000 to 40,000 for representation in the Senate, as well as for taxation, because that's how the states were won, or the people were represented by apportionment, and that's how they were taxed as well. So apportionment meant both representation and taxation. Nevertheless, Madison added an amendment because he knew that that number could not be arbitrarily changed by Congress. So he did Congress a big favor by creating a mechanism of how to change it from 30 to 40, and then from 40 to 50. If they wanted to go beyond that, then they would need to write a new amendment, but he gave them the style of how to do that by using the amendment process. And yet, in 1929, Congress decided to arbitrarily pass the Reapportionment Act, where they can control that number on their own without even abiding by the constitutional standard of having to amend the Constitution. So anyway, back down to Trump. This is going to take the talking of this and the details of this, because I know just by me talking, I can confuse or get things convoluted or make people feel like it's getting convoluted. To be clear, there are two things. So let's just keep this in mind here. We've got a judiciary problem that Trump has been trying to deal with. We also have an invasion problem that Trump has been trying to deal with. And we actually have states that have been running an insurgency against the Constitution, Washington State being one of the principal states. Washington State being a principal state running an insurrection against the Constitution by trying to give aid and comfort to those invaders and trying to actually legitimize them. And actually, they are legitimizing them in Washington State and all these other progressive or blue states. They're giving them access to voting and so forth, which there's no doubt in my mind this has got to be infuriating President Trump. So here's the question. Does President Trump want to actually make, you know, such a dramatic recovery? I've got 20 seconds here, so I don't want to lead into this because I can't actually go, you know, I can't say it in 20 seconds. So President Trump is at the greatest opportunity of probably going down in the history of being the president that actually restored the Constitutional Republic to a degree more than any other president ever. Now, Madison was the stalwart in keeping the federal government into the framework of the Constitution. So Madison and Jefferson, those guys kind of kept the federal government from going off the rails. And then after that, every president started, you know, creating the deviations, the variations of the direction of the federal government from the way the Constitution was designed to take the federal government, and ergo the variations, the contract variations, what we need to do to actually get them back. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Trump, what has Trump got to do with this? Does Trump have the ability to actually do something that would create such a change in the political makeup of the United States that would actually put it on track or on par closer to the constitutional configuration? What is at risk here is the future of American politics. Believe it or not, folks, because Trump is literally fighting the judiciary and their overreach. And the judiciary has kind of read the tea leaves, and they're kind of giving him some favorable latitude. But that doesn't mean that the leopards have changed their spots. To be clear, as we look at the judiciary, the Supreme Court specifically, is the Supreme Court going to be genuine? They're going to be honorable, they're going to actually do their job in supporting the Constitution? Is the federal court, the Supreme Court, going to actually do the right thing? So Trump can play this game and see if the Supreme Court is actually going to do their job. Let me just say this. If Trump does this right, Trump can literally put the federal courts, the Supreme Court and the entire federal court system and the state court system back into the bottle, getting the genie back into the bottle. How can he do this? By enforcing the supreme law of the land. We talk, how many times do we, I've been saying this for how many years? A decade, more than a decade. If you really look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, it does not give judges, federal or state judges, latitude to vote their mind. They are required to support the Constitution. The Constitution is clear. If you are here and you're invading, you do not have a legitimate need to be here. You are not entitled to due process. First off, due process is only entitled to a citizen. If you want to go through every instance of due process within the Constitution, it is only guaranteed, or in other words, the protections of privileges and immunities being due process is only guaranteed to U.S. citizens. This is where I tell you, don't become a state national, because you lose that protection. Even though nobody understands who you are, what you're doing, and they let you get by, the day is going to come when people are going to listen to G.R. Mobley and say, those people who became state nationals, they're not entitled to due process. They're not entitled to freedom of speech. They're not entitled to, freedom of assembly or petitioning government for the redress of grievances. They chose to not be citizens. They removed themselves. And right now, they should be counting their blessings that we haven't turned and shifted to them and go, why are we allowing you to stay here? because at this point we need people that are demanding compliance of the Constitution, not people running from it. And so, unfortunately, most of these people, they, you know, we look at them as good people, patriots even. You know, they're just trying to do what's right, at least what they think so. But, you know, when an obligator, you know, or somebody who has an obligation as a citizen, because every citizen has the obligation to support the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. That's active support. And if necessary, taking up arms to do that and use deadly force to obtain compliance of the Constitution. Not to bail out, not to, you know, to check out, run away. Anyway, back to Trump. So Trump now is in the sweet spot because he's got these circular energies, this political energy now running in the court system. And he's got political energy on trying to end this invasion. Unfortunately, he's not looking at it constitutionally. He's just looking at deporting bad people. I think he's afraid of the consensus because America really believes that this is an immigration crisis because that's how it's been preached for over a half a century. Even before Reagan, it was considered an immigration crisis because we used to actually have open controls on migrant workers. That was well before Ike was in office. People would come across the border as migrant workers, and they were somewhat documented to come into America for that purpose. And when some of them didn't leave over time, and it became more and more problematic, this all happened from the early 1900s, to, you know, a half a century, to where Ike ended up having to execute what we call Operation Wetback. Go read the petition. That's exactly what Ike, or President Eisenhower, referred to the operation of shipping out a million or so, I'll just say, invaders, people that came here and stayed. That was a million. Now we have 50 million. Everybody's talking about a housing crisis. Everybody's talking about a resource crisis. Everybody's talking about all of these burdens that are being placed upon our system. You can't put 50 million people in a less than 300 million populace. Less than 300 million. Folks, we have 50 million invaders. If you go through the petition, we actually use the MIT Yale survey, the study that they did, where they attributed in 2018 to having 18 million at that point. And I'm telling you, they padded it softly. I think that they actually, you know, overlooked many people because they didn't want to really, you know, put the numbers out that they were probably reaching 40 million by that point. And easily from 2018 with Biden and his open borders policy, there's no doubt in my mind we're beyond 50 million. The consensus of 2020 had us just a little tick above, and they were counting illegals for the most part, a little over 300 million. If we've got 50 million, then that takes us well under 200 million citizens. Let's just do the math and let's just cut it down to 270, right? Maybe we had about 320 million, 50 million off of that. Let's just say 270. So that is a lot of drain. That's almost one-sixth of the population is draining us because they have no right to be here. They're not obeying our laws, and they're actually functioning, you know, in the corners that are just completely throwing off our labor markets, our housing markets, and everything else. Now, the real estate housing markets and all of these people who've been getting rich off this invasion over the past 20, 30 years, you know, they've got their comeuppance as far as I'm concerned. Because those people who've been building homes and all of that and had a chance to actually do the right thing and say, we need to stop this invasion. But no. This is the goose that's laying our golden egg. See, the goose that lays the golden egg is the problem, right? It's just like citizenship. It's just like it's just like conservatives, you know, pointing to the problem, saying, follow us, we're going to get you out of this and give us money. All of these conservative organizations that are taking your money, that The problem is their goose that lays their golden egg. It's the same thing with businesses. It's the same thing because now everybody's been selling out. And people have been losing their jobs because corporations are selling out to foreign, you know, such as I could say Smithfield's been bought out by China. China is now unconstitutionally owning real estate. They're owning corporations. They're operating and owning things within the United States that they don't, the Constitution doesn't allow these things to happen, folks. So all of this, and who are Smithfield's employing? They're employing the illegals. So that everybody's losing their jobs. This is such an extravagant warfare against the states and the people. And folks, you've got to wake up. You have to start taking the argument that wins. You can't walk into a court. You can't walk into a venue and tell people this is immoral. This is, you know, unfair. You know, this is the wrong thing to do. We're killing babies. We're losing jobs. You know, we shouldn't be helping these people. Those arguments will never win. The arguments that win are they don't have the authority to do this. The Constitution demands that they repel invaders. The Constitution does not delegate them power to abort babies. The Constitution did not grant the Congress or the Senate to basically ratify a treaty to subjugate us to foreign courts. When you make the constitutional argument that the powers don't exist, that they're not there, and that going through the ratification debates, folks, this is why we do this. The ratification debates are the legal terms and definitions that were provided to the states of what those lines meant. This is a fundamental premise of contract law. Now, I will say this. I've been rattling the ratification debates ever since I've come on the air. And I'm actually being told that people are hearing other people mentioning the ratification debates instead of the Federalist Papers. I did a Google search. On Google, I looked at what are the definitive documents that, for a person, the gold standard in understanding the Constitution. I forgot the string, but I'm putting it in my latest article. And Google comes right back and says the Federalist Papers and court rulings, other than the Constitution itself. And when they point to the Constitution, they're meaning the living Constitution. The living Constitution being the one that the court updates as they redefine everything. As they've assumed all these unconstitutional powers, they've even assumed the ability to rewrite the Constitution as they feel fit. All of these things you will read, you will understand if you read my article, Why Counties Matter Most. Now, I'll give you this, folks. There's no difference in the price of Why Counties Matter Most for the soft copy or the hard copy. You pay the same price. It's free. Oh, hold on here. You know, why am I doing this for free when, you know, the great one, Mark Levin, is selling his book, so, and people are buying it gobbling up that trash. Everything that's being written by these conservatives, they're selling you their books. They're not giving you the solution. They're keeping you fixated on the problem. And boy, that problem's bad. And now that I've read this book, I understand the problem a little better. Doesn't get us any closer to fixing it. Nobody wants to show you how easy this is. And I'm just telling you, I don't make it easy. The divine hand of providence inspired a system that once you actually back up and you look at it, you go, oh my gosh, this is that simple. It may seem complex, but I don't think you have to have a complex mind to really understand the immune system of the human body. I mean, most people, having gone through COVID, I think we've garnered a little bit on the immune system. So, back to Trump. I'm going to be doing this for the next couple of days. Back to Trump. Trump has the ability to actually change the legislature in every state. If it is a blue legislature, if he does the right thing and actually calls out the Supreme Court for unconstitutionally reconfiguring the United States, unconstitutionally reconfiguring it in the 1960s by this stupid principle of one person, one vote, and he basically tells the Supreme Court by using states, because we can actually get state attorney generals and state movement to actually say, hey, give us our legislature back. Give us our county suffrage in our state legislature. Restore the county suffrage in the state Senate. That's how it was up until the 1960s. The only reason nobody remembers is how many people were old enough to understand what happened with the Warren Court and the shifting. Unfortunately, even the people at that time didn't even understand what they were doing. At that point in time, everybody just accepted this concept that the judges had all power. Because everybody, the only document that we had in the 60s were the Federalist Papers. Where were the ratification debates? It wasn't until 1976 when the University of Wisconsin decided to do a bicentennial celebration of the Constitution and actually do a documented history on the ratification of the Constitution when they brought out the ratification debates. 1976, they had languished in obscurity and just completely had been obviated by the legal community and everybody else. And as a matter of fact, lawyers, an honest lawyer will tell you that if they went to a school that actually taught about the Constitution, they downplayed the ratification debates. They said that was just drivel. It's just a waste of time. That is not the definitive guide. It's not the gold standard. The Federalist Papers are. And that's why we have this problem. Ergo, the necessity of writing an article that actually attacks and removes the Federalist Papers from any light. What I mean by this is not to obviate it, to basically say the Federalist Paper never deserved to be the gold standard. The Federalist Paper was the poisonous pill that empowered the not the legislature, but the Judicial Department and the Bar Association to create this monstrosity of and rewire our legal system so that they could start getting rich and they could start funneling money out. And so that they could pervert us and absolutely subjugate us to the globalists. You know, when you look at the judiciary, there's no representation. The only representation you see in the Supreme Court and the federal courts is, where did they get their degree? Oh, it was from an Ivy school, or it was from an upper class, Berkeley, Yale, Harvard. Not a school based on the Constitution. In other words, this is where all of these unconstitutional, the best word is evil. I don't want to use label something with demagoguery, but the reality is when you really look at some of the things that was being done by the court, by the Scopes trial, the separate but equal rule by Hugo Black. These concepts were literally evil because what they were doing was they were waging war against Christianity in the early 1900s. And they were saying, well, they were doing this academically. Well, it doesn't matter if they were doing it academically or if they were doing it upside down. They don't have the constitutional authority. The courts had no jurisdiction to be involved in education to dictate that creation couldn't be taught. Let me read the very first amendment to the Constitution that was ratified. In other words, technically, we're talking about the Third Amendment, right? So when we're talking about the Third Amendment, that means out of the 12 amendments in the Constitution, we call it today the First Amendment. It was technically the Third Article. And so the First Amendment is this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, they can't make a law regarding religion or even talking about religion or education. Even though education is not a delegated power in Article 1, Section 8. The only education that the federal government has a responsibility to is to educate our young people to be prepared to become members of the militia. That is, they're only to help educate the tactics and disciplines of the militia. It's right there in Article 1, Section 8. That is the only education that they have the authority to spend a penny on. And yet they've been teaching your children to become deviants. They've been teaching your children to actually surrender their constitution, surrender their liberties, and believe and trust in government almighty. Folks, all I can say is that Trump, in these next couple of years, can absolutely make it so that 2028, America will never have to be concerned about the progressives. We only need a few very critical or strategic wins. So the first win is to actually get the judiciary back into the box. We need a president that is willing to actually pull out the Constitution and actually point to the 14th Amendment, Section 3, and say, right here, if you fail to support the Constitution, you directly violate it, or you give aid and comfort to those who are violating it, you will be removed and banned. We're not throwing you in jail. But after you get banned, you may be tried and go into a court for crimes that you have committed. And as a matter of fact, I think that there's a lot of people that want to see that. But to me, get these people out now. You don't even have to go to court. Why is it that everybody wants to see the perp walk so that they're, you know, the next thing is they're standing in front of the court getting their bail hearing? Why are we waiting for, you know, charges to be made when we don't have to make charges? We just have to say, you violated your oath, you're gone. It's clear. The vote in maintaining this invasion, the vote in trying to stop the repelling of the invaders, all of these types of, that is empirical data that they are voting or actually violating their oath by not supporting the Constitution and the repelling of invaders. Anybody under oath, if they are unaware that the Constitution demands it and they're voting otherwise, they say, I didn't know, then they falsely affirm their oath and they don't deserve to be in office either. We can't have pity on those people who are actually destroying us. I mean, why is it that we do this? I mean, there's these movies and metaphors that actually, you know, create the conditions where, you know, when we finally catch the evil that is being, you know, leveraged against us, these people, this person that is doing these, oh, please have mercy on me. And we forgive them. And the next thing they know, they go right back to doing bad things. The Constitution doesn't allow it. The supreme law of the land is clear. You violate your oath and or you give aid and comfort to those who are violating their oath by not calling them out. So to be clear, for you to support the Constitution, you, one, actually vote against any insurgencies. And those who voted for the insurgency, you must hold them accountable to say, oh, by the way, your vote in casting a vote in passing a digital currency in the state of Washington means that you actually directly violated your oath of office because you are not allowed. The Constitution forbids us from passing a law or voting for that type of law, and you voted for it. Therefore, you directly violated it. And I don't want to be guilty as a legislator of giving you aid and comfort by not holding you accountable. I am obligated to hold you accountable. This is exactly why Madison said what he said in the Virginia resolutions, that the legislatures or our public servants who are under oath are legally obligated and duty bound to interpose, to seize these people and say, you must get out. The problem is that part of the Constitution didn't exist with Madison or Madison would have referenced Section 3, and it would have made life a lot easier. This is why I've said that the framers didn't see some of the problems. They needed to have an airtight process of holding everybody accountable. And the only way to do that is to actually have a process in there that says, hey, you have to be under oath. You must be legally obligated to support the Constitution. And then giving the people the power. So the first two dots were in the Constitution, the legally binding oath. And then in the second dot being the right of the people to petition government for the redress of grievances. So we can hold them accountable when they're not holding each other accountable. So we've got that. But the third dot means that if we actually call them out and we prove that they have violated the oath, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is clear. You don't go through jail. You don't get impeached. You don't go through some legal process. You have committed perjury, and ergo, Section 3 is about your qualification, your eligibility of office. In other words, you violate your oath. You are no longer eligible to be in that seat. It's like a governor of a state deciding to move out of state while he's still governor. The moment he takes residency in another state, he is no longer eligible to be governor. He's basically removed himself based on his eligibility. That's exactly what Section 3 is. It is strictly an eligibility mark that says, because you violated this obligation of supporting the Constitution, because you directly violated it, or you just gave aid and comfort to those that were violating it, then you're gone. I'm telling you, this was it. I mean, this was the final drop or the final dot in the Constitution to make a plane. To be right, 3 points make a plane. Anybody understand geography? If you have 3 points, it doesn't matter where it is in space, 3 points make a plane. Now we have a surface. Now we have a flat surface. You're no longer able to be on that surface. You're gone. You have made yourself ineligible, gone off the plane. So we have the opportunity, and I only have less than a minute, so we'll carry this into tomorrow. We have the opportunity for Trump to actually do a couple of things that will transform. And so we'll dive into the transforming tomorrow. But he will be able to transform the landscape of the state's politics by actually starting with the invasion, starting with the Supreme Court, and then finishing with the Supreme Court and the federal court system by holding them accountable to that oath. So Section 3 is the foundation at this point. Everybody has to understand that Section 3 is the dagger. It is the weapon. It is the tool in the Constitution of removing everybody that does not have a right to be in office anymore. They have basically made themselves ineligible, and we need to make sure that every Supreme Court justice, every federal judge, everybody at the state level, we're holding you accountable. And if you violate, you're gone. I'm Gio Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.